Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to a new week here on Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, we're talking about power today.
Can I stop you real quick?
Yes.
I just want to let you know that it's October.
Oh, yes, it is.
It's October 1st. So just take a moment.
And just, how did it happen
so fast? How did it happen so fast?
October 1st. I actually been feeling this ever since we got into fall. So
okay, never mind.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah. When fall hit, I was like, oh my goodness.
I falsely assumed. October, by the way, for my money, the best weather month of the year.
Really?
Top to bottom.
Oh, I love September. But yes, I'm ready. I have on my turtleneck already.
September starts so hot. That's my issue with September.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where I think October pulls away.
Yeah, it's good. I love the fall. It's my favorite season.
Conversation for another day. Go ahead. Sorry.
But today we're talking about power, nuclear power to be exact. It's been 45 years since the worst nuclear accident in American history. 3 Mile Island, for a lot of folks, especially in our region, it evokes very strong memories. That site, Avi, you probably know, had been shut down completely in 2019. But now there are efforts to reopen it. Microsoft has a deal with the owners to be the exclusive customer for the nuclear energy coming from that plant. Microsoft needs all that power to fuel artificial intelligence. Okay. And they're not the only one. A lot of companies that use AI, they're looking to nuclear power as a solution. So, Avi, you pitched this show. So we have a question for our listeners. Do you think nuclear power is a safe and green energy solution for our future? We want to hear from you, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. And Avi, true confession, I did not know very much about nuclear power before preparing for this show. So much to learn. And I'm sure there's a lot of folks like me.
Oh, I was very much like you.
Yeah.
That's why I was interested in the show topic, because I thought to myself, this is something I feel like
I should know a lot more
about. We already have a lot of comments coming in. And can I just say, they're so good. Our listeners are amazing.
Great listeners.
We want more good comments, right? Mm-hmm. More. You can never have too many. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. First, however, Cherry,
yes,
a trio of local news stories. And let's start you off with a little bit of sound.
Union power. Union power. No contract. No work. No contract. No work. Who are we?
That sound?
Yeah.
From this morning at the Port of Philadelphia, where dock workers are on strike. On strike here in Philadelphia and at sites all across the country. There is a major impasse between the International Longshoremen's Association and 36 ports across the United States. 45,000 members on strike, the first of its kind since 1977, Philadelphia included, as you just heard. Philadelphia, not a huge port in volume compared to some others, but a leader in terms of refrigerated products. So lots of produce comes through the port of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
The major, you know, conflict is, yes, around wages, but interestingly, just as much around automation. The union wants to limit the amount of automation that's implemented at the port here in Philadelphia. There's more automation, interestingly, already at ports on the West Coast. But here in Philadelphia, trying to limit the advancement of automation at the port, which would, of course, potentially cut into jobs.
Yeah, the interesting thing that stood out to me was workers are asking for a 77% salary increase over the course of 6 years. Their base salary is around $81,000, but many make up to $200,000 a year with overtime. Had no idea that folks working on the docks made that kind of money. And, you know, they're also, you know, as you mentioned, want some of those job protections. They'll still handle cruise ships and military cargo things during the strike. But I mean, you're thinking about the holidays coming up. I was on a group chat. Everybody's like, get your liquor now for Thanksgiving.
That was the takeaway. Of course.
But I mean, that was the group chat. But I mean, this could have some serious, you know, repercussions.
Sure.
Of course, President Biden could intervene if he wanted. But I saw, you know, a clip of him saying he would not.
Yeah.
This is what, you know, collective bargaining is about. But yeah, and I also wonder how this will impact prices going forward. Just so many questions.
Tons of questions. But let's turn now to President Biden's home state of Delaware.
Yes.
where another type of infrastructure story is playing out. Cherry, I think you're pretty excited about this.
I was very excited.
Okay.
And I'll tell you what it is. Wilmington Airport in Delaware is about to get a whole lot bigger. Three times bigger.
Three
to be
times.
Exact, thanks to a $10 million renovation. Mm-hmm. About $5.6 million of that funding comes from the bipartisan infrastructure law. Now, Avi, I know your question was $10 million doesn't sound like a lot of money when we're talking about renovating an airport.
To triple the size of an airport, $10 million does not sound like a lot.
But this is a teeny tiny airport. Okay, and so this $10 million will be transformational. And the airport terminal is so small, only one plane with customers can fit at the airport at a time. It means that the number of flights in and out have been very limited, and they only had a vending machine. They didn't even have food options. That's how small this airport is. But
maybe it was a great vending machine.
Yeah, it probably, hopefully had like, you know, some produce in there. I don't know.
Give me something.
Something in there, like an energy drink. I don't know. But with this expansion, the terminal will grow to 7,500 square feet, which is three times the size it is right now, which isn't that big.
Yeah,
but now they will have food
point.
And beverage options. They will have, you know, enhanced customer experiences, additional passenger gates. They'll have better baggage handling. So it's transformational.
It's always tough, I feel like, for the Wilmington Airport because it is just geographically so close to PHL. You know, PHL is in the southwestern part of the city. But I guess there seems to be some demand. They got some money from the federal government. So Godspeed to the good folks at the Wilmington Airport in Delaware. And before we wrap up our local news chat today, I just wanted to note the passing of two former Philadelphia sports legends. Pete Rose died yesterday, age 83. Pete Rose spent most of his career with the Cincinnati Reds, but was a member of the Phillies for their 1980 championship and actually on the team when they made the World Series in 1983. They say, Cherry, to not speak ill of the dead. So in the spirit of that, I will say this about Pete Rose. He was an extraordinary baseball player. In keeping with that same theme of not speaking ill of the dead, I can't say too much more about Pete Rose, to be quite honest with you. He was built to play baseball. He was a phenomenal baseball player. We also lost yesterday Dikembe Mutombo.
Giant.
A giant in so many ways. In so many ways. Dikembe Mutombo spent most of his career in Denver and Atlanta, but was part of the 76ers team that made it to the NBA Finals in 2001. Dikembe Mutombo was a center. A defensive center, rugged defensive center. He would block your shot. He wasn't sort of all that great on the offensive end, but was a legendary defensive player. And his work off the court really belies that reputation because he had a huge heart. He was known for his humanitarian work. He died at 58 due to brain cancer. So just a tragic loss to Dikembe Mutombo. Do you remember him as a basketball player?
Yes, I do remember him as a basketball player. He played 18 seasons, record for second most blocked shots. I was like, what?
Yeah, amazing defensive
player. He was amazing. And now, you know, I feel like he was 7 foot two, but now we have more players that are over 7 feet. But he was really a giant. And one of the things that I read about him was he had actually gone to college to become a doctor.
Went to Georgetown to become a doctor.
Did not even intend to become this basketball superstar, but becoming that helped him bring so many resources to his home country of Congo. And then just to be able to do so much for the people back home for him meant so much. And so rest in peace.
Well, just an interesting contrast between the two.
Yeah.
You know, it was said of Mutombo, you know, he was not a great offensive player, right? And it was often said of him, you know, why don't you sort of work more on that part of your game? You spend all your offseason doing this humanitarian work. And he said, basically, I play basketball to do the humanitarian work. You know, Pete Rose, a very different figure. He was consumed with baseball. He once said, allegedly, I'd walk through hell in a gasoline suit to play baseball.
Wow.
And it seemed like life outside of baseball for him was in some ways peripheral. And, you know, again, I don't he just passed away. We don't have to go too deep into it. But I do think there is a telling contrast between the two men. Both spent short amounts of their career here in Philadelphia, but are well remembered and made huge impacts as players here in Philadelphia. And so We did not want to let this segment pass without at least mentioning the both of them.
For sure. And coming up, we're talking about nuclear power. Do you think it's safe and a green energy solution for our future? Email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Welcome back. I'm Avi Wolf-Manero.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. For many folks in our area, the name Three Mile Island evokes memories of America's worst nuclear accident more than 45 years ago. Here's a clip with anchor Walter Cronkite on CBS News from the date March 28, 1979, the day of that accident at Three Mile Island. Take a listen.
It was the first step in a nuclear nightmare. As far as we know, at this hour, no worse than that. But a government official said that a breakdown in an atomic power plant in Pennsylvania today is probably the worst nuclear reactor accident to date. There was no apparent serious contamination of workers, but a nuclear safety group said that radiation inside the plant is at 8 times the deadly level, so strong that after passing through a 3-foot-thick concrete wall, it can be measured a mile away.
And while there were no fatalities, the nuclear power plant went into financial hardship that it never recovered from. It eventually closed in 2019.
Nuclear energy does not have the best public image. I always think of Homer Simpson messing up at his job when I think about nuclear energy. And look, some of that reputation, Cherry, is well earned. There are concerns about nuclear waste and potential meltdowns. But there's also an upside, vast amounts of carbon-free energy. And we do need energy. That's why Microsoft recently signed a deal to reopen Three Mile Island, at least part of Three Mile Island, to power its AI data centers.
And so we wanted to ask you, our listener, our question of the day. Do you think nuclear power is a safe and green energy solution for our future? You can email studio2@whyy.org, or you can call 888-477-9499.
Jerry, let's reintroduce our guests. Not reintroduce. Let's introduce them for the first time. Then we'll reintroduce them later. How about that?
Exactly.
Okay. Rob Altenberg is director of the Penn Future Energy Center. Rob, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We also have John F. Kotek, Senior Vice President of Policy Development and Public Affairs at the Nuclear Energy Institute. John, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Well, thanks for having me.
And so, John, I wanted to start with you, and I wanted you to give us a basic understanding of how nuclear power works. We want to understand the science. How do they generate energy here?
Yeah, you bet. So with a nuclear power plant, what you're doing is you're converting the energy that's released when you split an atom, principally an atom of uranium, into electricity or some other form of useful energy. So in a nuclear power plant like the one at Three Mile Island, what you're doing is causing atoms to split, which release heat, which is used to heat up water that's kept under very high pressure so it doesn't boil. That water is run through something called a steam generator, which has on the outside of some tubes lower pressure water that is allowed to boil. That steam from that boiling water then goes to drive a turbine, and that's how you generate the electricity.
And so explain how this is considered to be clean energy, because it sounds complicated, but it's considered to be a clean energy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it from a number of perspectives, not the least of which is that the process of producing electricity from nuclear power doesn't release any carbon, also doesn't release any oxides of nitrogen or sulfur, the things that cause air pollution, which has been so problematic in our history as well. Nuclear offers a number of other advantages, very low land use, for example, very low life cycle mineral use, so you don't need as much mining. For a number of reasons, nuclear is viewed as a very clean source of energy, on par with things like wind and solar that are also going to be increasingly used in a cleaner energy future.
Rob Altenberg, I'd love to do a little history here. When did nuclear energy become a reality in this country where people were, powering homes with it? And what was its basic trajectory over sort of the lifetime of nuclear energy's, you know, real world possibilities? Like, how did it rise? How did it fall? Give us a sense of that story, that narrative.
You know, well, we saw a really increase of peaceful uses of nuclear power. You would see the Atoms for Peace program in the 1950s into the 1960s, and there was a number of different proposals out there. We saw nuclear power plants start to be built in the 50s, ramping up through the 60s and 70s. Right about the time that where Three Mile Island occurred, we that wasn't the last deployment of nuclear power. But right after that, there was Three Mile Island, certainly Chernobyl not long after that, we saw the deployment tend to stabilize worldwide and really have not seen a significant uptake in additional facilities since then. There's certainly proposals to build additional ones, and every now and then a new one will come online. But we've really stalled our development since not too long after the Three Mile Island accident.
And where did we stall at? Give us a sense of how prevalent nuclear energy is today on our power grid.
Well, in Pennsylvania in particular, we now have four nuclear power plants that generate roughly 30-40% of our energy. So it is still a significant part of our power grid. When we see it, and Pennsylvania, we are part of a much larger grid that extends from North Carolina to Chicago. We actually export 30% of our generation outside of Pennsylvania across our borders. So that nuclear energy is going much, much further than just our borders.
And John, I want to bring you back into the conversation and ask you about some of the challenges connected to nuclear power and harnessing that power, and specifically dealing with waste. Can you talk about some of the challenges that, you know, companies deal with when they're trying to stand up or recommission a nuclear power plant?
Yeah, I sure can. Let me jump in real quick on the last question, just to round that out. Nationwide, we get almost 20% of our electricity from nuclear power, from 94 nuclear power reactors. I should point out, Pennsylvania actually has the second largest number of operating nuclear reactors. As Rob said, four nuclear power stations, eight reactors total. That would be nine when Three Mile Island comes back online. And Pennsylvania also has the largest number of companies that are active in the nuclear energy supply chain. So nuclear in Pennsylvania means more than just the plants, but it's also big companies like Westinghouse and Curtis Wright and others who are very big players in the
nuclear
power
sector. And on that point, let me just ask you, John, I mean, so if you're a household in this region, the chances that you are getting some power from nuclear energy is what? It's rather high?
Yeah, 100%. In the state of Pennsylvania, very very big source of generation. In terms of some of the challenges, so one of the things that we've seen over the years is some real improvements in the operation of nuclear power plants. So if you go back to when I started in this industry 35 years ago, the average nuclear power plant only ran about 65% of the time, give or take. Today they run more than 90%. In fact, between 92 and 93%, a typical average year. That's because the plants have gotten a lot safer. You can run a safer plant a lot more often. The operators have gotten a lot better at running them as well. And so what you've seen over the years is improvements in things like the plant design and equipment, revamping of operator training, and other things that have helped the plants to become the most reliable source of electricity generation we have in the United States. As we look forward, you mentioned things like waste. Waste is certainly an issue that needs to be addressed. In fact, I used to be responsible for the nuclear waste management program in the federal government when I worked for the Energy Department at the end of the Obama administration. And there are efforts to try and bring back a program to safely manage spent nuclear fuel for the long term. As your listeners may know, the federal government took responsibility for providing a final safe resting place for spent nuclear fuel back in the early 1980s. Unfortunately, hasn't delivered on that commitment yet. Other nations have. So Finland is about to open up their spent nuclear fuel repository. Sweden has chosen a site. Our neighbors to the north, Canada, they're selecting from two volunteer communities that want to host their repository. So we know how to do this safely. We just need to get past the stalemate that exists in Washington, D.C. over that. The good news is that in the meantime, it's very straightforward to manage this material safely. So after fuel spends 5 to 6 years in a reactor producing power, when it comes out of the reactor, it's still thermally and radioactively hot. So first you have to cool it in a pool for a few years, and then you can put it in something called a dry storage cask, which is just an air-cooled steel cask or container with a concrete overpack. And that just sits on a concrete pad outside the plant site. So it's very straightforward to manage safely. We've been doing it for decades. I used to work at a facility that hosted multiple spent fuel storage sites. So that's one of the challenges. We do have other things, bringing down the first-of-a-kind costs and getting to reliable and timely build-out of new nuclear is something that we're working on. And then having the manpower, you know, the personnel to staff these facilities. Mm-hmm. The Energy Department estimates we're going to need 375,000 people to do that. So we're going to need to bring those folks on as well.
Wow.
Let me read in some comments. Bradley, and our question, by the way, is do you think nuclear energy is a safe and green solution for our energy future? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Bradley says, yes, 100%. Nuclear is the preferred baseload generation source of nearly every scientist and engineer. Max also says, yes, it's absolutely the best tech for clean energy now. In 50 to 70 years, when those reactors reach the end of their life, hopefully innovation and focus has resulted in a new energy production technology that is better. So Max and Bradley are on board. And I think what both of them are alluding to there, Rob Altenberg, is the idea that nuclear is reliable right now, and in particular that it delivers energy in a different way than other types of clean energy sources like solar and wind. Can you go into that a bit? What distinguishes nuclear from other types of so-called clean energy sources?
Well, certainly one of the things that is that nuclear has going for it is that high capacity factor, where it runs at a very high capacity output from the plants consistently over time, where you have solar, wind, and other sources like this are variable sources of energy. Now, traditionally on our power grid, we were heavily dependent on so-called baseload power. For a long time, Pennsylvania, 90% of our generation or more was coal and nuclear combined. So very heavy in this baseload power. What we see today is our grid is much more capable of dealing with variable resources. Typically, we see solar and wind as those resources. The question of what is the best power source for the grid. Now, the big difference with solar and wind, it is far, far cheaper to install solar and wind than it is to install nuclear.
Yeah. Let me read this email from Catherine, by the way. It says it takes on average 10 to 20 years to get new plants online. We don't have that time because the climate is heating faster than we are acting. We need to switch to totally affordable solutions like wind and solar. New battery storage options are coming into fruition. She also mentions geothermal. So, Rob Altenberg, is that kind of your point? That, hey, we don't have time to scale up nuclear here. It's expensive. It's labor intensive. Mm-hmm. Let's go full throttle with solar and wind.
Well, certainly the last nuclear power plant we had in the permitting process was PPL's Bell Bend plant, which was canceled just after 2011, I believe. That was projected to cost $15 billion to install that plant in 2011. Georgia just finalized a project this summer. I believe it was $30 billion over budget. So these are very, very expensive plants. Now, where as an environmental organization, we recognize the value of that carbon-free generation. Restarting TMI saves about 3 million tons a year of carbon pollution going into the atmosphere and a lot of other pollutants. So preserving the existing resources we have until we can ramp up other cleaner and cheaper resources to replace them, we see the value in that.
But you're more skeptical about building new reactors, is what I hear you saying.
Yeah. Well, and PPL, they tried to build another reactor in Pennsylvania, and they simply couldn't get financing. Mm. It was far too expensive. We see we're at Three Mile Island. Now, Three Mile Island only had one nuclear generating unit at the plant compared to our other four that have two reactors. So they had really all the expenses with half the generation, and they were consistently losing money. I mean, that's why the plant shut down. Mm. There was an attempt to subsidize them and keep them in operation, but it was simply too expensive. I will agree that there is value there, and there's certainly other new technologies, small modular reactors and things like that, that are being discussed. But it's a very, very expensive investment if we say that's the way we're going to go. And the permitting timeline is just very, very long.
Yeah. I want to ask the question to our listeners. Do you think nuclear power is a safe and green energy solution? You can call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. And I want to bring in one of our callers. Charles is from Philly, wants to talk about security and nuclear power. Charles, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I just wanted to mention that Three Mile Island came very close to being much worse disaster. We were very lucky that it was handled so well. Fukushima proved that storage on site is extremely dangerous, mm-hmm. and they're still having problems with the storage there, trying to manage that. Nuclear power is inherently dangerous. The aging reactors are much more likely to have a disaster or have an accident. New reactors and new technologies improve, but they still don't overcome the dangers in this technology. There's already many safe alternatives, and we should rely on and invest in those.
Thank you so much, Charles, from Philadelphia. That's a fantastic point, Jerry.
Yeah, and I wanted to bring this up because in 1975, I saw in some of our reading that 65% of those polled were in favor of nuclear power. But after that incident at Three Mile Island, the anti-nuclear movement found success. And after hearing Charles's comment, you hear about what it triggers, just the thought of Three Mile Island. Can we talk about, and I also researched and found that there had been dozens of nuclear accidents over the years, about 56 in the United States, but there are ranges to them. And so, Rob, can you talk a little bit about what could happen? And I know that every accident is not created equal, but that is a big concern that I think a lot of people have when they think about nuclear power.
Yeah, and I mean, I certainly share that concern. I was in middle school living not too far from the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant when parents started to show up evacuating their children from the school. So the trauma associated with that accident, certainly in the area I grew up, lasted a long time.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, finish the thought, Rob. I get a bunch of things I got to clean up here.
I certainly recognize that risk associated with the generation. There's the operational risks of the plants themselves. There's certainly the questions about how we handle the waste. There's ongoing environmental impacts, whether it's the thermal effluent from cooling systems and how that impact occurs on the stream, on the streams or whatever the system that's used for the cooling water. So a wide range of environmental impacts that we can see from these plants.
I want to make sure John Kotek gets a chance to respond,
please,
to some of this, because, and I also want to clarify that Charles said something about Fukushima, mm-hmm. talking about the plant in Japan that was impacted by the tsunami there. So John Kotek from the Nuclear Energy Institute, a lot of people in our comments are concerned about storage, mm-hmm. and the potential for a disaster. Stephen commented along those lines. Nuclear waste remains dangerous long past the viability of any known materials or measures to contain it. So, John, you've heard a lot here. I want to give you a chance to respond.
Yeah, please. And so let me kind of start at the top here. We heard earlier concerns about the time it takes and the expense of building new nuclear. And Rob alluded to the facility in Georgia, the Vogtle 3 and 4 reactors. He said $30 billion over budget. That's wrong. The company that built them says the overnight capital costs, without financing costs, was something like $21 billion for those two reactors. Still certainly more than they intended to pay, but very much in line with projections in terms of the final impact on consumers for those projects. Mm-hmm. The bottom line there is, a few weeks after those reactors came online, the governor of the state was talking about wanting to see a fifth unit built at that site. Okay, so they see it as a success. In terms of the time required, we've got to remember that, yes, things like wind and solar themselves can be built faster, but to do the job of cleaning up our electric grid at scale with huge deployments of renewables is going to take enormous amounts of long-distance transmission to make the system work. So estimates from coming out of Princeton, for example, say we'd have to have about six times the amount of transmission line miles as we have today. Okay, now, when I was in the Obama administration, the administration designated seven long-distance transmission lines for priority siting. This was in 2014. Okay, 10 years later, about 15% of those line miles have actually been constructed.
Can you essentialize what you're saying is that basically we cannot pump all that solar and wind onto the grid in the time that we need to. So we absolutely need nuclear. Is that what you're saying?
We have to get serious about building out all the clean energy we can at scale now. Okay. So the point about
every
the
tool in the toolbox.
We need every tool in the toolbox. And where a lot of the good wind resources are in the U.S., for example, are in the center of the country.
Right.
Well, the load tends to be on the coast, so you need to move that power. Solar, best in the southeast, right? But, of course, that's not where everybody lives. So you need the ability to move that power around the country. That takes just as long as building a nuclear power plant. And, frankly, I've worked on siting transmission lines and wind farms and nuclear power plants. Nuclear power plants are easier to site than transmission lines.
Right.
Because the communities that are impacted also benefit. That's why you saw the communities, and community leaders around Three Mile Island advocating for financial support to keep that plant running.
Because that's where the jobs will end up being, is what you're saying.
Because with the jobs and the tax base and the people who work there know it's safe. To the point about the plant being canceled, the order about a dozen years ago, what happened was natural gas got really cheap.
Yep.
So when you had companies 15 years ago saying we're going to build new nuclear power plants and then canceling those plants, that's because fracking was invented. Okay. So today people care about carbon emissions, right? When these projects were canceled, people weren't putting a value on carbon emissions. And so they were happy to just burn natural gas and get cheap electricity. The more you care about carbon, all right, and the more you put a price on carbon, the more attractive nuclear power gets. So this really
that's when we get into government intervention, right? Right, John? Because that's what we're talking about there. Penalizing the carbon emitters, which makes nuclear financially more attractive, is what you're saying.
That's exactly right. And let's remember, both the federal government and state government still give financial support, right? Tax incentives or renewable energy credits for wind and solar. Right. So it's not like these things are going without financial governmental support as well. So I think what we need to be talking about doing is building out both of these as fast as we can. I'm happy to take on the safety question if you want now. But I've been talking for a while, so happy to turn it back.
Yeah, let me get a caller in before a break. This is Gail from Wilmington,
Delaware,
who wants to talk about another safety concern. We did talk about storage, but there's also security concerns, right? And so Gail is on line 4 from Wilmington, Delaware. Gail, you're on Studio 2. We are close to a break, but what's your question or comment?
Well, my father was in the nuclear power business, and I honestly think the technology is pretty safe, and I think that there are ways we can resolve the waste issues and stuff. But what does concern me lately is what's happening in Ukraine, where the Russians are using these power plants almost as weapons.
Yeah.
And what kind of safety concerns, I mean, how are we handling this here in the States, and what's being talked about?
And I think you're referring to the Zaporizhia power plant that is right in the middle of this conflict between Russia and Ukraine, an active land war. And so on the other side of this break, I would love to get John Kotek's take on that, because I think for a lot of folks, even if they understand the broader benefits of nuclear, they are understandably concerned mm-hmm. about that one big accident, that one
too.
Plant that's located in the wrong place at the wrong mm-hmm. time. So we're talking about nuclear energy. We're going to address Gail's concerns, hopefully, on the other side of this break. And also, Cherry, we want to talk about perhaps some innovations in this space.
What does the future look
what
like?
What does the future yes. look like for nuclear? We've heard about fusion. We've heard about smaller nuclear mm-hmm. reactors. Is that a potential solution here? So we're talking with John Kotek, Senior Vice President of Policy Development and Public Affairs at the Nuclear Energy Institute, and Rob Altenberg, Director of the Penn Future Energy Center. Let's give out the number one more time.
Yeah, the number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And our question of the day is, do you think nuclear power is a safe and green energy solution for our future? Again, 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
And Colin asks us, can your guests shed some light on modular nuclear reactors, a new technology being deployed on the West Coast? We're going to do just that, Colin, on the mm-hmm. other side of this break. Great question from Colin. Great concern given to us from Gail in Wilmington. We're going to talk about both of them on the other side of this very short break. You're listening to Studio 2 right here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We are talking all about nuclear energy this hour. And let's hear from you. Do you think nuclear power is a safe and green energy solution? Email studio2@whyy.org. You can call 888-477-9499.
And I want to reintroduce our guests. We have Rob Altenberg, Director of the Penn Future Energy Center. We also have John F. Kotek, Senior Vice President of Policy Development and Public Affairs at the Nuclear Energy Institute.
And we teed this up before the break, John. You heard from Gail in Wilmington talking about the potential that these nuclear facilities can become pawns, very dangerous pawns in geopolitical affairs. Give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So first of all, our hearts go out to the people of Ukraine, and we commend the work that is being done on the ground by the International Atomic Energy Agency. That's the UN's nuclear energy watchdog. What the Russians are doing is irresponsible. And needs to stop. In terms of what that means for the use of nuclear power here in the United States, I feel like we as the United States don't need to worry about a foreign adversary coming in trying to take over our nuclear power stations. In terms of the security of those plants themselves, actually the largest single part of a nuclear power plant workforce is the security. And so in terms of the level of protection that's afforded to those plants, they have to pass rigorous testing done by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission periodically. That's something that is well in hand.
John, let me ask you, though, about I don't know how much of this is science fiction stuff we see in movies, mm-hmm. but a missile strike or some mm-hmm. sort of sabotage, some sort of terrorism. I think people are worried about the potential for, and I'm not using this quite literally, explosive consequences when it comes to nuclear power.
Well, and that's something that was looked at after the 9/11 attacks, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as well as the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations, the Electric Power Research Institute, we at NEI and others, all examined the level of physical protection of the reactors. And the fact is the reactors themselves are enclosed by very robust concrete and steel structures that are very resistant to that sort of attack. And so that's something, again, that the industry has learned from past experience and has well in hand. And it's something that, to the question you received about modular reactors and some of the new designs, the newer designs that are going to come online are going to be even better than what we've got now by virtue of having learned from the 60-plus years of design and operating experience that we have. And so, you know, instead of relying on things like pumps and valves to keep the reactor fuel cool and ensure that the workers and the public are protected, these designs are going to use what we so-called passive safety features. So you're relying on things like natural heat convection or gravity instead of active systems to ensure the safety of the reactors. That in concert with things like more robust fuel designs, and placing facilities underground in some instances. There are a lot of things that are being done to make the next generation of nuclear plants, particularly the modular ones that your questioner asked about, even better than the already very good plants we have today.
Yeah, and John, I have a question for you because, you know, companies like Microsoft, Amazon, they need mm-hmm. a lot of power. And I'm wondering what other alternatives that do they have? I mean, because it seems like the nuclear power plants, I mean, and in this case, Microsoft is basically going to be able to take all the power from what the recommissioned Three Mile Island. But how much power do these companies need? And are there other avenues that they could get that level of power from?
Yeah. So to your question is a great one because that's where we're seeing a lot of the demand for and interest in new nuclear. So a typical nuclear power plant will produce about 1,000 megawatts or 1 gigawatt of electricity. Some of these companies like Microsoft, but also Google, Amazon, other big data and AI companies, they're looking for hundreds of megawatts, if not several gigawatts, of firm, clean power. Mm-hmm. And they're interested in nuclear because it runs around the clock. So Rob talked mm-hmm. earlier about the fact that we've got less baseload generation on the grid. And I do expect to see less so-called baseload on the grid going forward. But we're going to need a significant share of what we call firm power. So, again, another term for baseload. Nuclear can do that. And companies like Microsoft and Google and others are committed to decarbonizing their electricity use. And not just by purchasing renewable energy credits and matching up annual energy use with the purchase of credits. They want clean power minute by minute. Right? They want to know that their operations are being powered by something that's carbon free. You can do that with nuclear. Mm-hmm. And that's why companies like Microsoft or like Amazon Web Services at the Susquehanna nuclear plant there in Pennsylvania are signing big contracts for nuclear power offtake.
Lots of our commenters, mm-hmm. however, are dissatisfied with this specific use of nuclear power. Laura says, I support nuclear power, but not for wasting it on AI. Mm-hmm. Jordan says, I'm fine with nuclear as a green power option. I'm less thrilled about using it to make up for the power hog that is AI. I'd rather see nuclear support our existing power needs rather than subsidize new technologies that are tearing through resources. That won't help us reach carbon neutrality. And we are sort of splintering into a different conversation now, Rob Altenberg. But, you know, it does feel a little bit like we're trying to green energy our way out of this problem instead of simply curtailing energy consumption writ large. What do you think about that question, that conundrum, Rob Altenberg?
Well, certainly energy efficiency is the most cost-effective choice that you can implement. The cheapest watt is the one that you don't use. In some areas, that's a lot easier than others.
Yeah.
Certainly, we're concerned about things like the TerraWolf project, which is diverting carbon-free nuclear generation from the Susquehanna station to wasteful crypto mining operations. Yeah. You know, certainly, you know, we don't want to see that. But we do have, and this is to challenge some of the comments that John made a bit earlier. We do have very good choices in clean renewable generation, and it is cheap. We talked about this Three Mile Island project being about a gigawatt of power. Texas put about 10 gigawatts of solar on the grid in a single year. Our grid has the capability of having far, far more clean renewable generation than we have now. The levelized cost of new solar is about, you know, it starts at about $0.02-$0.025 a kilowatt hour. Solar and storage units combined, we're talking $0.04-$0.05 a kilowatt hour. Mm-hmm. That cheap gas, $0.04. New nuclear is more in the 14-cent range, according to a recent study. So that 14 cents a kilowatt hour, it, you know, if we're going to be heavily reliant on nuclear, that is going to be paid for on electric bills. So the reason why, you know, we're seeing, you know, existing nukes, which are fully depreciated, already paid for by ratepayers and relatively cheap, certainly we're seeing groups like Microsoft gravitate towards that. But it is a very expensive solution. And not to say we shouldn't do any of it or won't have mm-hmm. any of it. We probably will. But we have to look very carefully at where we are putting our resources. Investing in energy efficiency, I think this should be our first choice when we can do that. Mm. After that, we want to look at what is clean and cheap, and solar is by far that. You know, our grid can handle far more. We are going to be building out grid capacity anyway for the data centers. We're going; it's certainly going to be required. But we have existing capacity to have far, far more than we have now.
And I'm sure John has a response to that, but I want to work in another caller now. Yeah. This is Hunter from Delaware County on line one, who was a nuclear power officer in the Navy. And we love to hear from folks with on-the-ground experience. Hunter from Delaware County, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Oh, I was just wanting to say that, you know, the Navy has been running nuclear power safely since the 1950s without accident. The number of kilowatts generated is astronomically large. And so so I think that nuclear power, when done correctly, which, you know, 99.9% of the time it is done correctly, is probably the cleanest form of power that we have available to bridge the gap to renewables.
That's a great comment from Hunter in Delaware County. And I do think it probably tees up John Kotek here because, you know, Rob is really skeptical about the cost, about scaling this. I want to give you a chance to respond a bit to what Rob laid out. And perhaps you'll steal a couple points from Hunter there.
Yeah, well, Rob's certainly right. We're going to need a lot more wind, solar, storage, and the transmission to tie it together. But every credible study I've seen out there that doesn't rule out nuclear power from the start includes a healthy share of nuclear power as that firm, clean source of generation to make the system work. Mm. And so it doesn't matter where you are in the country, having that firm, clean power is worth paying a little bit more for. You don't need 80% base load like we have today nationwide going forward, but you're going to need something in the 20, 40, 50, 60% range, depending on where you are. And nuclear power, I think, is the best position to play that role. So this isn't, you know, either or. This is, we're going to need both. In terms of the question that we got about AI, this is an interesting one because I certainly understand the sentiment.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's a real concern here in Washington that the U.S. is poised to lose out on the AI race to China because we're not going to have enough power to run the AI systems at the scale we're going to need, right, to continue with the learning. Right,
and that could have economic implications moving forward.
Yeah. And so that's one of several reasons why folks in Congress are now starting to look at, all right, what are the things that we can do to accelerate permitting, which is going to help renewables and nuclear, but also to help accelerate the build-out of clean technologies at scale.
And I want to read this email from David who says, if Microsoft will take over Three Mile Island for their power needs, then they should be involved from cradle to grave. In other words, they should pay full price for the fuel, no government subsidy, and be responsible for the spent fuel waste disposal. Proper disposal is a formal repository, not storage on site. And I want you to kind of talk about this because it is expensive. A lot of these AI companies are going to be directly benefiting from this investment, but who should pay for this? Should taxpayers be the ones that foot the bill to help fuel this AI industry that in many ways is probably going to be taking some of our jobs?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Little known fact, actually, nuclear power has paid for its waste disposal. So for 30 years, the industry paid into something called the Nuclear Waste Fund, 0.1 cents per kilowatt hour of every kilowatt hour of electricity generated from nuclear. As a result, there's more than $45 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars sitting in the federal treasury to pay for the development of a final repository. So the resources are there. in terms of who should be responsible, under federal law, the federal government is responsible. So they've taken this responsibility on in large part because the government has nuclear waste of their own from the Nuclear Navy program, from our weapons program, from various research programs. So the government already knew they were going to have to build a repository. They drew in the industry to say, okay, you help us pay for this and we'll take care of the spent fuel. So that the financial part's taken care of.
Rob Altenberg, some final thoughts as we wrap up. And we did not get to fusion, the holy grail of fusion. I'm sorry, Jim, who asked about it, perhaps another show. But Rob, just closing thoughts here in 30 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I don't disagree that nuclear power is going to continue to be part of our grid. I think the danger we have whenever we talk about new technology, whether it's building new nukes, small modular reactors, things like that, is we lose sight of the things that we can do now. We have the technology to rapidly and cheaply expand energy efficiency and clean generation like wind and solar. We should be focused on doing that.
Okay.
Invest in other things, but let's do what we need to do.
All right. Well, it's been an enlightening conversation, some great insights all around. That was Rob Altenberg, director of the Penn Future Energy Center. Rob, thanks for the time. And John Kotek, senior vice president of policy development and public affairs at the Nuclear Energy Institute. Thank you as well for your time, John.
Thank you.
And thank you to all the folks
thank you.
Yes, and thank you to all the folks who emailed in. And you probably saw that nice email
from
Bill. Go right ahead. That was so wonderful.
So we talked about Dikembe Mutombo,
yes,
who just
did.
Passed away at the beginning of the hour. And Bill emailed us and said, I was working on a PhD in the early 1990s at Georgetown. I taught an introduction to linguistics class. Dikembe Mutombo was one of my students. It was clear even then that he was special. We used to speak Swahili to each other just for fun. It was one of about five languages he knew. A giant that will certainly be missed in this world. Thank you for that email, Bill. Thank you for that remembrance of the great Dikembe Mutombo.
Yes, and rest in peace. That wraps our show today. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Al Banks engineered today's program from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Graves.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We will talk with you tomorrow.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.